This is the full moon night of May, 5th of May, 5th of the 5th, 2555. I also happen to be 55 years old, having been born at the end of 2499, so I can always remember what Buddhist year it is. So tonight's the night of the full moon. Also, apparently, this is the largest full moon of the year, according to the astronomers. In the Sinhalese calendar this year, this is the Visakha Puja night. In the Thai calendar this year, the Visakha Puja will come in 1 month's time. So we have an opportunity for a double celebration this year. Occasionally divergences in calendars like this. So Amaravati being a place where many different traditions meet, different Buddhist lineages, different spiritual traditions can gather. So we try to be respectful and appreciative of all these different recensions of how things are. So that I'm very happy to be taking today as something of a Visakha Puja observance. Also very glad people have put out these beautiful lanterns around the temple as well. And we'll be aiming to have our main full-scale celebrations of Visakha on the 3rd and 4th of June in a month's time. But it's also it's a good opportunity tonight also to consider the Buddha's birth, enlightenment, and final passing away. These are important, significant principles, central features of the Buddhist path, the Buddhist tradition, and tonight is a very good opportunity to reflect on those as well. One of the Buddha's, one of the aspects of the Buddha's enlightenment that it's good to consider in some ways is that in order to realize the truth, in order to awaken to the middle way, the Buddha had to give up his commitment to the path of mortification, the path of austerities. According to the stories, the legends, for 6 years the Buddha had pursued the way of life of an ascetic yogi, trying to reach the end of suffering by torturing the body, depriving it of food and putting it through all kinds of difficulty in order to, in a sense, conquer feeling by taking feeling to its painful limit. But he also realized at a certain point along the way that you could experience, a human being was capable of experiencing as much pain as he was knowing, he was experiencing himself. He could take it to the limit, but even though he could take pain to that limit of sort of maximum intensity, he saw, even though I can take pain to this limit, we can experience this much pain and no more. Still, even experiencing this much and being able to pay attention to this much pain, still I'm not liberated from suffering. I still haven't got beyond it. Even though I can endure the maximum possible pain, still I haven't got beyond the experience of suffering. And so it was realizing this is the limit to which feeling can go, and still I haven't got beyond it. It was that kind of insight or that kind of recognition that he began to listen to that voice in his heart which said, there must be another way, there must be a different way. So he had to give that up in order to awaken to the middle path, the middle way. He had to give up his commitment to the traditions and practices of the ascetic yogis that he had followed very diligently and with great commitment, dedication, for the previous 6 years. So in a way he had to fail as an ascetic in order to succeed as a Buddha. This is, I think, a useful and significant thing to think about, because oftentimes we we feel like we always want success in life. We always want things to get better and better. Yeah, in every day, in every way, I'm getting better and better. You know, these kind of affirmations that people are encouraged to bring to mind. And we always want success, and we fear failure. We like health and comfort, and we dread being unhealthy or uncomfortable. Or when we engage in a competition, we always want to win. We don't want to lose. We want to when we meet with people, we want to be approved of. We don't want to be rejected. These are very, very natural instincts. But if we reflect upon just something like the experience of the Buddha and his enlightenment, in a way he had to accept that he was going to give up the path of the ascetic, the self-mortification, as it's called, self-torture. He had to give that up to be, in a way, a failure as a self-torturing ascetic in order to come more deeply, more completely into accord with reality. And as the story goes, then after the enlightenment, a Visakha puja on the full moon of the month of Visakha, then he journeyed for a couple of months to rejoin his old companions, the five ascetics, in the deer park in Varanasi, outside of the city of Varanasi, Benares. And when they saw him, his old friends, his five companions, that their first reaction was, "Oh, it's Gotama. Yeah, he's the one who gave up on our old friend, our old teacher, our leader. Yeah, he was supposed to be the one who was guiding us and our good example, and he gave up on the ascetic life. He was a quitter. He failed. He gave up on the ascetic life, and he started eating irregular food, rice, milk rice porridge. And how could he have the nerve to come back and see us again when he was such a quitter, such a failure? What does he want? What's he doing here?" And then, as it goes in the stories, it's described how, you know, even though they had these negative critical thoughts, that they were actually incapable of ignoring him or being disrespectful. And so they, as he approached, even though they, between them in their conversation, they said, "Oh, we should ignore him, or we shouldn't treat him with any kind of respect." They couldn't stop themselves. So even as their mouths were saying, "We don't respect this person. He's a failure. He's useless. He lost it." Even as they were saying that, they were jumping up to prepare a seat for him and to get him some drinking water and to help look after him, receive him in an appropriate way. And then as they met him, as they said, "Oh, welcome, friend," the Buddha said, "Well, you shouldn't address me as friend, because things have changed now. You can't really talk to me just in the way that you used to, because things have changed, gone through a major shift since we last met. So, you shouldn't just chat with me like an old buddy. In fact, it's more appropriate to talk to me in a more respectful way." And they thought, "What do you mean respectful? You're a quitter. You're a failure. Why should we be even more respectful? You're lucky that we're being as friendly and as deferential as we are." And the Buddha was undisturbed by this and said, "Well, friends, the deathless has been attained. The Dhamma has been fully realized, and that since we last were together, I've realized full enlightenment, full awakening." And they say, "Well, how can you possibly be fully awakened? You gave up on the ascetic life. You're a quitter. You gave up the spiritual life. You started eating milk rice. You were eating porridge, like more than three rice grains a day. How could you possibly be enlightened? You're a dropout. You're a failure. You're useless. How can you possibly pretend that you are really someone who's attained enlightenment?" And then, as is usually the case in these exchanges, they went back and forth three times. And after the third time, that when the Buddha said, "The deathless has been attained," you know, that since that last time that we met, I have fully awakened to the Dhamma, fully realized the truth of the way things are. And he said, "Have you ever heard me talk like this in the past?" And they said, "No, we haven't." He said, "Okay, listen, friends, the deathless has been attained. And if you pay attention, in no long time, in a very short time, I'll be able to explain to you how you too can also awaken to this same reality." And so then after the third time around, they thought, okay, we will listen. And so then the Buddha gave them the teaching on the middle way and the Four Noble Truths. And certainly, surely in no long time, firstly, Kundanya awakened, became a stream enterer, and entered the first stage of enlightenment. And then a little while later, after he gave the teaching on anatta, on the teachings on not-self, then all five of his former companions became fully enlightened, just as he had said, just as he had predicted. So in this respect, it's helpful to consider our own life and the things that we might consider difficulties or failures, or when things fall apart or things are challenging, that it's very easy for us to consider, oh dear, this is the worst thing. I got fired from my job, my relationship's coming to pieces, my health is collapsing, it's all over, it's hopeless, everything's falling apart, my family or the community and my meditation practice. Oh, I used to be, last year I really had good concentration, I could just sort of sit down, my mind would go clear, and now, yeah, just come in the temple, where it used to be that I came in the temple and my mind went super quiet and everything went peaceful, the sound of silence was some beautiful roaring presence. Now I come in the temple and my mind is just a confused jumble of nonsense. And it's all falling apart. It used to be so good, and now it's all collapsing. All of us have these different kind of experiences within with our physical health, or our family, or our working situation, our community, that in any different dimension of our life, we all have these kind of experiences. And it's very easy for us to take hold of that feeling of failure. It's all come apart, or it's all, it used to be so good and now it's not working anymore. Or it's a broken system, it's a broken engine, my wheels have fallen off, it's all over. And we can take hold of that perception and grasp it and then become very depressed or confused or feel that life is hopeless on account of that, and not realize the way that nature works is that sometimes things have to fall apart in order for us to progress. Like the Buddha had to fail as a self-torturing yogi in order to succeed as a Buddha. Yeah. But that one particular aspect of his life had to fall apart and not work in order for him to look deeper, to see more deeply into the very core of the reality of things, to help him awaken to the Dhamma. So this comes up for all of us in many aspects of our life, and so I feel this is a very significant aspect of Buddhist practice. And often when I'm giving instruction about meditation, I often will use phrases like, that practicing meditation is not about forcing the mind to concentrate on a single object, but it's more about learning how to fail perfectly. And you think, well, that's pretty stupid. Surely we want to succeed. What can it mean to fail perfectly? But I picked up the phrase in some respects from a story that the very eminent Zen teacher, Trevor Leggett, is a very wonderful Buddhist teacher. I think he's passed away now. He would, if he's not, he'd be about 103. But he used to give talks at the Buddhist Society Summer School and wrote quite a number of books. He was living in Japan. He worked for the BBC World Service in Japan for many years, and he was the highest ranking judo expert outside of the Japanese community. He was the highest ranking foreigner. He was something like a ninth Dan black belt judo practitioner, and the highest qualified gaijin, foreigner in the judo world, but also a very, very wise and gentle-hearted person. And I remember, I think it was at one of these talks he gave at the Buddhist Society Summer School when I was along with Lumpur Sumato one year, and he told this story of how this the BBC were interviewing this man who'd been a tutor, an English tutor for the royal princes in the Japanese imperial family, and they were asking him, this man who'd been an English tutor, what did he feel was the most important thing that he was able to impart to these royal princes. And he said, well, these children are being raised with the idea that they have descended from the sun god, that even though there's a bit more realism in the mix, still that they are very much in the royal family, and they're held up in the highest, most exalted position in Japanese society. So that I consider the most important thing that I could teach these two boys to do is to learn how to fail perfectly. And that stuck in my mind, because the interviewer, as Trevor was recounting the story, was a bit confused. He said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, that when we are assuming that success is good and failure is bad, then we're always creating a polarity in our own heart. We're creating opposition and contention in our own heart. We're creating stress in our own heart, our own mind. But when we learn how to fail perfectly, that what that means is that when things fall apart, when things don't work, when our arrow misses the target, or when we pronounce something wrongly, we get the wrong words, when something we say to somebody upsets them rather than inspires them, or something that we are putting our energy into doesn't come about in the way that we wish, then rather than being letting ourselves be overwhelmed by that bitter taste of things not working, or someone disappointing us, or breaking our heart, or something that we put together collapsing, we recognize the bitter taste of it, but our attention goes on to what we can learn from that, so that we recognize that things come together, things fall apart, and in that they're perfect. This is the way that all things are in nature. And so that when we are able to fail perfectly, what that means is that we hold that experience of failure in a context. And we see that, one person's failure is another person's success, and also that sometimes what we think of as a disaster or something difficult can be the seeds of something very, very beneficial. And so I often use the example of asking people, so can you think of an event in your life where you were so happy, you passed the exam, the person that you were infatuated with responds and says, yes, I love you too, you're so wonderful, you're so marvelous. Your project succeeds, you get promoted, you get hired, you get accepted, you get ordained into the community. And then 5 years later, 10 years later, you look back on that and you think, I was celebrating. How could I, when I got that job, how could I possibly have been so stupid? I was rejoicing, I was so happy when I got that appointment, I was so happy when I won that prize, I was so happy when I hooked up with that person. And look what happened. And 5 years later, 10 years later, we can see, so much suffering, so much difficulty came from that. So what we looked upon as something that was a great success and was a big blessing, we can see how it turned into something painful, difficult, oppressive. I probably don't need a show of hands that all of us can think of some area of our life where we experience that. that we look back and think, oh, I can't believe that I was rejoicing at that. And look what it turned into. And then the opposite, which is on this theme of how something is painful or difficult. We have some horrible disease, some kind of injury. Someone breaks our heart. We get thrown out of a job. Someone leaves the community that we were inspired by, and they disappoint us, or they reject us. And at the time, it's extremely bitter and difficult, painful. And the last thing we would have wanted, some life-threatening illness or some permanent injury, some irreversibly broken relationship. And then, 5 years later, 10 years later, we look back and we think, well, I never would have asked for that, but that's the best thing that ever happened to me. That actually forced me to grow up. I had to really get wise. I had to expand my heart to accommodate things. I had to grow up and to learn lessons that I never would have learned if I hadn't been challenged in that way. So this is a tremendously important area of practice for all of us. And I feel this is something to really take in, because when we're faced with difficulties, when we're faced with pain and loss or failure, then there's a very strong instinctual reaction to judge that, to recoil, to become depressed and oppressed. And yet, when we let the view expand, when we broaden the heart, when we rather just hold that experience in the space of our awareness and just know, oh, this is the flavor of loss. This is the flavor of the breakage, something breaking. Then we know it just as that. Then this is how we fail perfectly. This is how we're able to know that quality of nature in its context and realize, oh, this is just seen from one particular point of view. This is how it is. This is the feeling of it. This is the experience of it. It's just one perspective. I remember Lumpur Samedo often talking about the time when he was a young monk, and the Ajahn Chah had taken on a large number of monks for temporary ordination at Wat Bapong, and I think it was about 22 or 23 people who'd taken the bhikkhu ordination at the beginning of the rains retreat. And normally in the past, Ajahn Chah had not taken on temporary ordination, people for temporary ordination, but had only really accepted people who were thinking of a long-term commitment. But this time he'd been persuaded that it might be a good idea. But at the end of the rains retreat, not only did those all 22 or 23 of those temporarily ordained people disrobe and leave, but they created a kind of flood in the rest of the monks, so that the bug spread, and so there was a large number of long-term quote unquote monks also were queuing up to disrobe as well. And Lumpur Samedo, I was often told the story of how Ajahn Chah did, after these requests to disrobe were coming from this side and that side and all over the community, Lumpur Chah gave the Bhikkhu Sangha a real roasting one day and said, "Why didn't you all leave? You are so clueless and faithless. Why don't you just all clear out and just me and Samedo will stay here? That all the rest of you can just buzz off and leave us alone. None of you really know what you're doing here anyway." And because it was at that time, there was that feeling, Ajahn Sumedho described, oh my goodness, this monk's leaving, that monk's leaving, Ajahn so-and-so's leaving, everyone's leaving. maybe I've got it wrong, maybe this is all pointless, maybe there is no purpose in this, and it was really affecting him very strongly. And I think he felt quite flattered that Lumpur kind of named him as... just the one who had remained behind with him, but still he recounted that feeling of intense doubt and despair. Oh dear, it's all falling apart. Wat Bapong, used to be so filled with this idea of onwards and upwards, Ajahn Chah is the greatest teacher in the world, and people keep coming here, and more branch monasteries, and everything's getting better and better, and brighter, and bigger and bigger. And then suddenly, whoomph! Everything seems to be collapsing. All these reliable people, these pillars of the community, you're all lining up to go back into trousers and go back to work in the bank or out in the fields. And that sense of shock or threat that he felt at that time was very strong and caused him to doubt. But then also, as many of you will have heard him saying in numerous Dhamma talks, then because of that intensity of doubt and the sort of unsettled feeling that it brought up in him, then he did his best to apply the teachings to that and say, okay, well, yes, this is shocking or sad or threatening, but what should I do with this feeling? Rather than just buying into it and believing in it, he made the effort to work with that and to take that threatened feeling and to use the energy of that sense of threat or sadness or depression or insecurity, and then to use that to really look, to fire his powers of reflection and investigation, to look within himself and say, okay, well, if everybody did leave, if all of them, even if Ajahn Chah left, all the junior monks and a few of the Ajahns taking off, what if Ajahn Chah decided that he announces to the Sangha, okay, well, everybody else has left and I'm going to go too, and there's this really nice girl in the village and I'm going to be getting married to her, so, good luck, guys, I'm off. He said, what would I do if Ajahn Chah announced that he was getting married to a girl from the village? Or what would I do if Ajahn Buddhadasa says, Buddhism is a farce, Christianity is really the true way, so I'm going to go off and join the Christians. And what would I do? What if the Dalai Lama said, actually, communism is really the true way, Tibetan Buddhism is completely misguided, and I'm going to go over and join the Chinese and become a card-carrying communist. What would I do? And it was obviously a time of a powerful insight for him, because he realized when he allowed himself to think the unthinkable, if Ajahn Chah did say he was going to leave and get married, if Ajahn Buddhadasa did say, I'm actually a Christian, what would I do? And when he allowed himself to think the unthinkable and to meet that doubt face to face, he realized, well, the Four Noble Truths are still the Four Noble Truths. The Dhamma is still the Dhamma. It's still Sanditiko, Akaliko, Ehipasiko. Apparent here and now, timeless, encouraging investigation. The Dhamma is still the Dhamma. The Four Noble Truths are still the Four Noble Truths. There are still people in the world who are probably prepared to offer a monk some alms food. So even if these great mentors of mine, even if everybody left, then what would I do? Would just continue to practice. What else is there to do? And so that even though it had been sort of a difficult or challenging or sort of threatening experience, aroused doubt in him, then by meeting that doubt, by meeting that difficulty, that sense of loss and threat, it actually opened the door to a far more profound quality of faith and confidence within himself. He realized, oh, look at that. Because he knew for sure that if all his mentors and heroes did disappear, that actually within himself, all he wanted to do was to live as a bhikkhu and to practice the Dhamma and to be going out for alms food every morning into the village, and to be relying on the faith and generosity of the greater community for the support of his life as a samana. So even though it was a situation that was challenging and painful, threatening in some respects, it actually became a source of a great strength and clarity, and an even more profound commitment to the practice. It meant that he wasn't relying on Ajahn Chah to always be present and supporting him, or always to be inspiring and good. He wasn't relying upon the inspiration of his mentors, or even the practice or the commitment of the people around him, but rather he saw that actually it's here, it's right in this very heart is the source of wisdom, the source of peacefulness, the source of that which is good and that which is truly liberating. So it became a cause for a much greater independence and clarity within his own heart. Also, I remember him talking about later, much later time, when Ajahn Chah's health had collapsed, and he really wasn't in the mix. Not that he'd run away, but his health had caved in. He'd had a stroke. He was paralyzed, couldn't speak anymore. And I remember vividly after one visit back to Thailand, Lumpo Samata saying, "Wat Bopong is like a ghost town." So all the nuns are still there in the nuns section, seemingly. 30 or 40 nuns in the nuns section, but the monk side said there's 6 monks. There's Ajahn Chah in his nursing kuti, and there's 6 monks looking after the whole place. There's Ajahn Subin running around, sort of taking care of all the practical things, and Ajahn Liam is the second monk, meeting the visitors and taking care of the running of the monastery. But that's all there is. He said it's like 35 empty kutis, and there's half a dozen monks, he said. But even though it looks like it's all fallen apart, everyone, so many of the monks have all disappeared and gone away, Ajahn Liam seems to be absolutely unflustered, unbothered, and not being caught up in that. And I think that was also very a strong message to him. And sure enough, even though it dipped all the way down to half a dozen monks of busily taking care of all the duties, then before too long more and more people came back and started to help out more, came in to nurse and look after Lumpo Cha, and then as time went by, then all of the energy of the monastery picked up again. So even though it went into a major sort of energetic dip, then it was part of a natural cycle, and then it came back around again. And so now Lumpo Liam has his own very, very committed students, his own disciples, and has a very good reputation, is very admired. They have all the kutis on the monk side are well and truly filled, and the number of branch monasteries has more than doubled since the time that Ajahn Chah became ill. So the community did indeed sort of return to a quality of robust, good health. Even though at a certain time, I remember when Lumpo Samedo came back and told those stories, he was impressed that Lumpo Liam was not bothered and that he had a lot of upeka, equanimity. But you could see he was still quite, whoa, it's a shock to see Wat Bopong with just literally half a dozen monks there. That's something that is impactful, but also that lesson having been learned. Like, well, yeah, it might look as though it's all falling apart, or it's all kind of grinding to a halt, or all the wheels have all dropped off, but don't panic. This could just be the appearance of things. Don't react, don't panic, just attend to that, notice that, be with that, and then just see how the cycles work, see how the cycles look after themselves, see how the thing, having reached that particular phase of its changes, then see how, it all swung around and came back, just like the changes of the moon. Right now the moon at its peak, also the brightest, biggest moon of the year, it's reaching its peak, but it'll in 2 weeks' time it dips down turns to a completely dark presence, loses its light altogether. Where we get lost in all of this is of course that sense of identification with success and failure, gain and loss, praise and criticism, fame and disrepute, or happiness, unhappiness. These are the loka dhammas, the worldly dhammas that tug upon the heart, that convince us so repeatedly and so convincingly. The heart is drawn in by the sweetness of success, of happiness, the bitterness of unhappiness, of failure. This is where we get caught. There's the habit of identification. We claim things to be our own, that we mistakenly assume that we have the right to a body that's comfortable, that is healthy, that is free of obstructions. We mistakenly assume that we have the right to having a life which is predictable and secure, and that things will go in the way that we wish. And so that it's the reason why we experience so much dukkha, so much stress or difficulty, so much dissatisfaction, is because of that these habits of identifying. We get continually caught into our presumptions. And there's an analogy that Ajahn Buddhadasa uses. He says it's like being a thief, that a thief takes something that doesn't belong to them and they claim to be the owner when they're really not. And so that a thief knows that they've stolen something, and then when you get caught by the police, then you get punished. You're caught by the law, and then you receive punishment. He says this is just exactly what happens when we, like a thief, we claim that the body is ours, or we claim that the mind states are ours. We claim that our material possessions really belong to us, that we are the owner, that we are the true possessor of these things, and that but because we're not the real owner, it's like being a thief. We've actually stolen it. Then when we get caught by the authorities, then we get punished. We get caught by the law, but the law is more like a law with a capital L. Like we get caught by the Dhamma, which means we think that the body is ours, but then it disobeys us. We want it to be comfortable and it gets uncomfortable. We want it to be energetic and it becomes weak and tired. We want it to be healthy and it becomes sick. We want to keep the people around us that we love and are dear to us, and then they go off and live somewhere else. We want to keep the relationships that we have sweet and pleasant and supportive, and then people criticize us or disappoint us, or change their attitudes, and so we experience the sense of loss and sadness, disappointment, separation. So that this is like being caught by the law, so in a way it's like being caught by the Dhamma. There was a pop song from the late 60s or the early 70s. I fought the law and the law won. Someone comes to mind. Some of us will remember that. I fought the law and the law won. It's like I fought the Dhamma and the Dhamma won. I wanted the body to always be comfortable and to always be healthy. I wanted always to stay attractive and sweet smelling. And instead, it starts to get stinky, or it gets old and wrinkled, and starts spreading out, and the force of gravity wreaks havoc on my posture or my waistline. Wrinkles start appearing and the hair starts falling out. So this is why we experience dukkha, is that we're fighting the law. But the law keeps winning. You know, Dhamma, the reality of the way things are, keeps winning out. So this is pointed to over and over again by the Buddha, how, you know, when we are wanting things to be, wanting that which is unstable and insecure to be stable and secure, we have to be disappointed. If we're looking for security in that which is intrinsically insecure, we have to be disappointed. If we're looking for our income, you're looking for our money to be something that makes us happy or that is reliable, we have to be disappointed. If we're wanting our relationships or our spiritual teachers or our community or our spouses, our children, our parents to always be something which is sweet and supportive and delightful, they can't do that. It's impossible. We can't. It's impossible that our parents or our children are always going to please us. Our friends are always going to be exactly the way that we like. Or we ourselves. It's impossible that we ourselves are always going to fulfill our ideals of how we should be. If I was the perfect me, I would always be sweet, peaceful, and calm, and wise, and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. The other Ajahn Amaro is always like that. The ideal one. So if we are constantly identifying, trying to claim things as being ours and who and what we are, that really are not, just like the thief, the thief can get away with it for a time, but sooner or later the law catches up. And even in the meantime, the thief is always living in a state of tension and fear, worrying that the law is going to catch them. So similarly in our heart of hearts, our own wisdom, our own intuitive wisdom is telling us, you know, this doesn't really belong to you. Your life is not really your own. Your body, your mind, your moods, these belong to nature. Your faculties, your hearing, your vision, your mental acuity. Yeah, you're not really the owner. These things are subject to the laws of nature. They're not entirely controlled by your personal wishes, your personal preferences. So even now with this Venerable Narindo and our friend Nicholas, put a lot of effort during the last week boosting the sound system here, so hopefully the audio here in the temple is a little bit better than it has been before. Say, so, well, my ears are much better this week. Well, we do what we can to make the world comfortable, accessible, so that we give a Dhamma talk and everyone can hear it. We try to act in ways that are, say, sustaining friendly relations with other people. We look after our body to keep it as healthy as we can. We don't deliberately look for trouble. We try to set the world up in a way that is beneficial to ourselves and to others, but in a way we're fighting a losing battle, that we can only, in a sense, make the conditions of the world, you know, good enough, but we can and good enough to be able to, say, provide the supportive conditions for us to see and to reflect on the way things are. But it's important that we recognize we can never make it perfect. We can never make life totally predictable. We can never make it really secure. We can never be truly insured. Even though the insurance companies are extremely powerful and wealthy, no one can really be sure. We can't really be insured, despite what all the insurance companies promise. We can't create that. This is what the Buddha's teaching points to. So that the best approach then is to learn how not to be a thief, to learn how not to be making those claims of ownership and taking things which don't belong to us, taking the body to be self or taking our mental faculties to be self. You know, that they don't really belong to us. We're not really the owners. We're not really in control. And so when we witness that, when we say, thinking, oh, I really would like to be able to hear, but I can't hear well, or I used to be able to see clearly and now everything is a bit fuzzy, or when we try to remember things and our mind can't pick up the memory so well. Or like nowadays, I notice when I'm typing things, I mistype more and more often in interesting ways. So I'm kind of developing what they call dysgraphia, like it's a kind of a written form of dyslexia, so that my fingers will type letters in the wrong order more and more often. So part of me goes, oh dear, it's all falling apart. But the wise part will say, well, that's interesting. I used to take it for granted that when I wanted to spell the word the, that I would hit the T and then the H and then the E. And now with great regularity, I have the H-T-E, T-E-H, E-H-T. Oh, that's interesting. Look at that. Because if we're wise, we'll see, that's telling me the truth of the Dhamma. That's telling me that this doesn't belong. The mental faculties, the capacity to remember, the capacity to think, the capacity to see and hear and listen. We're not the owners. These are not a given standard right. These are temporarily functioning systems that can be used and can be of benefit to us. But in the long run, they have to go their natural way. They come together for a while and then they collapse. But even though when we use words like failure or collapse, I've often quoted Lumpur Liam's words from last year, where he said, you know, when you talk about things as being obstacles or problems in practice, it's really not, it's not helpful, not appropriate. It's not realistic to talk in those terms, because we should rather see that these are opportunities to learn, that what we think of as an obstacle or a problem, that really this is a chance to raise our game. Also, it makes me think of, I was living in California for many years, and they have these wonderful redwood trees that grow on coastal California, called Sequoia sempervirens. It's the Latin name for them. And sempervirens means always living. And these trees are quite marvelous insofar as they have these this way that when the tree dies or falls down, then more offspring grow up from its roots or from the trunk. If the trunk falls down, then little branches will turn into individual trees. Or if the trunk is cut off, then is destroyed by fire, then from the roots, from the what are called the burl in the roots, a whole new tree will grow up. So often you find these circles of redwood trees, and the original mother tree has fallen down and gone and rotted away, but the children have all survived, and then so that they grow up in a circle where they had arisen from the burl on the roots. And so when a redwood tree dies, then as it falls over in the forest, then you'll get a whole string of new trees growing up from that. And not only the shoots that are growing up from along the length of the tree, but also it becomes a seedbed, because it has this very spongy, thick bark. So when seeds from other plants come along and fall on the trunk, or they're dropped by the birds, then it becomes a perfect seedbed, like it becomes a nursery for all sorts of other plants. So they say a living redwood tree, if I can remember the statistics correctly, a living redwood tree supports about 13 other species, living species. A dead redwood tree supports about 80 different species of other plants and animals and birds and insects and such like. So a living redwood tree is a far more limited ecosystem than a so-called dead redwood tree. And so that when we think of something having fallen or having died or having come to an end or collapsed in our life, I find this is a good analogy to bring to mind, that maybe when something has fallen apart or something is not working, you know, when we have a physical limitation because of illness or aging, or we're having to slow down, we're having to retire, that actually we can discover much greater opportunity. We can become our life can become a more rich and valuable and potent ecosystem than it was when we were active and busy and sort of not retired, or when we were healthy. So the important thing is to, in a sense, get to know the habit of identification, this quality that the Buddha focused on in that second teaching, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. And that was the teaching that he gave that actually brought about the full enlightenment of his five disciples. Teaching the Four Noble Truths in the middle way, that only Kandanya was able to fully understand that and awakened to the level of stream entry, the first level of enlightenment. But it was when he gave the second teaching, this second discourse on anatta, on not self, that was what catalyzed, that's what triggered the full liberation of all of his five companions. So this is, in a way, the most essential insight, the most sort of valuable area for us to look at. What is this process of identification? What is it that causes that theft, that triggers the sort of the thief to take hold of thought and feelings, the body, perceptions, ideas, memories, and says, this is me, this is mine, this is my mind, my body, my life, my world, my things. In the legends of the Buddha's enlightenment, it's the trickster, the presence of Mara, the lord of illusion, the kind of Satan figure in Buddhist mythology. That's the force that tries to trick the Buddha, that tries to pull the Buddha into delusion. And that's in a way that's what is causing us to get fooled, that pulls us into being the thief. Or maybe a better image than being a thief is being a kind of dupe, is a good English word, one who's a poor sucker who's pulled into the trick. So whereas the Buddha, during the night of enlightenment, Mara comes along with all sorts of illusions to try and pull the Buddha in, to trick him. The illusion of threat, he sends in the armies to try and make the Buddha afraid and physically threatened, and he doesn't go along with that. He sends in his daughters to try and seduce the Buddha into desire, and he doesn't go along with that. He sends in the force of responsibility. He conjured up the image of the Buddha's his father's tear-stained face, old King Suddhodana, begging the Buddha to come back and take over the kingdom. So the forces of fear, the forces of desire, the forces of responsibility, all of those the Buddha responded to by saying, I know you, Mara. So in this way, we can think of Mara like a kind of second-hand car salesman trying to convince us, like, come on, I mean, this is really great. What about this? Look at this, fantastic. Look at this model. It's beautiful, wonderful. Runs like a dream. It's only 2,000 quid. It's a steal. It's like a... But then rather like the old famous American Democratic Party advertisements for an election when Richard Nixon was running. They just had a big billboard with Richard Nixon's face on and said, would you buy a second-hand car from this man? He was known as Tricky Dicky. So the Mara is like the second-hand car salesman, the Tricky Dicky that's trying to convince us, like, yeah, I mean, it's really, I mean, all this stuff about not self, I mean, it actually really is your life. I mean, you are a man, you are a woman, you are old, you are young, you are English, you are Sri Lankan, you are Thai. Yeah, you are a monk, you are a nun. Yeah. Really? I mean, let's be sensible. I mean, after all, we know, actually. It's like think of it as the voice of the second-hand car salesman. And that when I was living in the States, I was told that in second-hand car sales, there is this particular practice known as bait and switch. Bait and switch, which means you bait the customer by baiting an animal, like putting out a worm on a hook to catch a fish, that people are baited. In the window of the car showroom, you have a really fancy car, really nice, attractive car, and it looks extremely impressive and very cheap. And so it's, you know, this wonderful Ford Mustang, perfect color, only a year old, one careful owner, not very likely for a Ford Mustang, but yeah, only $2,000, and yeah, virtually new. And wow, that looks great! Look at that, $2,000 for a one-year-old Ford Mustang. Wow! So then, that having swallowed the bait, then the customer, the would-be, is drawn into the car showroom, and then the salesman says, "Oh, terribly sorry, the one in the window is actually sold, but I've got this other one out the back that's really, really good." And so, having drawn you in, then having put out the bait, then the switch is that, well, you know, here's this one. It's a little bit older, you know, like 15 years old, and got a few more miles on it. But by the time you've been drawn in, that you say, you know, you've now been convinced that you really could use a new car, then the seduction of the salesperson then draws you in, and then even though the object has been switched, you end up buying it anyway. You spend up more money for something you didn't really want, and then it lets you down. So this is Mara, I would say. This is Mara's practice of bait and switch, saying this is what we're being promised. This life is really great, you know, that we have this wonderful body, and it's always going to be healthy and good-looking and comfortable. And then that's the bait, or when we follow a promise or a hope or a convincing pitch, and we go along with it, and then Mara switches it on us. Then oh no, I thought this was going to be so great, but now I'm getting ill, or this person doesn't really like me, or this it was so inspiring in the beginning, and now I'm getting really tired and really fed up with this. And how come I joined this thing? How come I was so convinced? So then we have to learn how to say meet that the promise of the salesman, they meet Mara's bait, and to recognize, I know you, Mara. When we are say promised that all those different possibilities, whether it's a mind state or whether it's to do with our friendships, our relationships, our own body, whatever it might be, whatever aspect of our life, to recognize the bait. And there's the Buddha uses this example of a hunter, you know, Mara the hunter putting out the bait. But he says, if we're wise, then he says that we learn how to eat the bait, and then not get caught by the hunter. We can know that this is the bait. We know that there's a danger here. We know what it is, and we're not drawn in by it. We are able to recognize it, and not be pulled in. So this is the challenge that we have, is to learn how to recognize the pull of the habits of identification with our body, the personality, our role in life, our relationships, our occupation, you know, all of it. And just to be able to say, you know, I know you, Mara. I know you. And so we're not rejecting it or not trying to wipe it out, but just saying, this is the feeling of the human realm. This is what the taste of success is like, the taste of failure. This is what this particular aspect of the human realm, it feels like this, and we're not pushing it away, we're not grasping hold, but we know it. And this is the, in a sense, the true refuge of the Buddha, being that aware and open, awake heart that knows the different attractions and aversions, the things that pull us, the things that bait the mind, that say trigger those reactions of love and hate, so that the heart abides in that quality of knowing, of being aware, and is undeluded by that. And so this is also the way that we most deeply and completely pay our respects to the Buddha, is by being that very Buddha knowing, being that awake, pure, clear, unconfused awareness. This is how we most fully and completely express our puja, our gratitude and respect to the Buddha. So I offer these words for consideration this evening. Please take what is useful and what is not, please leave aside. Sadhu Karanga Dhamma Se